So we just want to mention that during the pandemic, it has often been a comforting and joyful experience to Zoom to a meeting. It is important to recall the ULT Declaration. The Philadelphia ULT meetings maintain anonymity, offer no crosstalk or side issues of personal anecdotes. Participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These are traditions that are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy of theosophy without the distractions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Let us all work to maintain these declared traditions. So we will turn this over to the chairperson. We're moderating the Zoom meeting from Theosophy Hall for those who are in attendance.
Thank you. This morning's presentation, mid-January, is based on the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And if you were to Zoom in or visit any of the other lodges situated around the world, you would hear the same declaration of shared purposes. So let's visit that first before we do anything else. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So all of the weekly activities of the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia were on Zoom in the greater sphere of influence. All of the activities are based on this declaration, and everyone who fits the category of feeling these declared purposes to be of great value, feel within their heart that you'd like to fit yourself by study and otherwise to this effort, please feel free to contact ULT Philip at AOL.org to volunteer. And if not for this lodge, certainly for another somewhere around the world. Now, as was said, we have weekly meetings, Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. On Wednesday evenings at 7:30, there is a Zoom presentation that opens promptly at 7:30 and lasts until 8:45. This coming Wednesday night is January 19th, and the theme is reincarnation. What is it that reincarnates? So again, we'll be looking at Ocean of Theosophy, a series of articles by William Q. Judge. And we will be in that text on pages 64 to 69. That text is available through the Phoenix ULT. It's certainly available for sale as well through the Lodge in Los Angeles. On Friday nights, we have another Zoom session that is radiating out from the Philadelphia area. And on Friday nights at 6:30, the Zoom session opens. It lasts until 7:30. And this coming Friday night is January 21st. We are studying a little book called The Echoes from the Orient, again, articles by William Q. Judge. And this coming Friday night at 6:30, should you declare yourselves ready to tune in, we will be on section or article Roman numeral 17. Next Sunday morning, as this morning, there will also be a session, only on Sunday mornings, it's a combo. It's a unified effort of those who are fortunate enough to get into Theosophy Hall at 1917 Walnut Street and the rest of us that are still Zooming. For the month of January, we're looking at Sunday theme of the path of spiritual evolution. Next Sunday is January 23rd, and there will be a panel, as this morning there will be a panel. But next Sunday, the 23rd, starting promptly at 11, is a panel entitled Slaying the Illusions of Mind. Again, if you are arriving in Philadelphia at 1917 on a Sunday morning, the building will open at 10:30, and there will be volunteers there ready, willing, and eager to welcome you. If you're Zooming in, the class will start promptly at 11. But it's one and the same, kind of a dual effort, if you will. So those are our announcements for now. This morning, we are continuing the monthly theme of the path of spiritual evolution. And we have a panel presentation, a two-part presentation entitled Silencing the Chattering Mind. So here goes part one. Mind, whether from the universal to the particular, no matter which way we consider it, it is one. Mind is a key concept in the study of theosophy, a force in the unfolding of the theosophical movement, a force in the path of spiritual evolution. It has been said that most of the talk a human generates is actually within, self-talk generated by the mind. Let us visit the nature of mind in this first part of the panel presentation and the potential of mindful spiritual evolution in the second portion of the panel presentation. In popular thought, we see traces of illusion. Some say that the brain alone is the host of man, the director of thinking. Some lament brain dysfunction when describing attention deficit disorder, powerful psychological drivers or motivators, self-fulfilling prophecies rooted in how a child was raised, negative self-talk, etc., etc. Still others in the popular society have adopted the ancient Buddhist nomenclature of the term monkey mind to describe karmic skandic tendencies toward restlessness, capriciousness, whimsy, fancy, confused thought, inconstancy, distractibility, or uncontrolled mental processes, kind of a passivity in the face of the gunas. The dilemma of developing self-consciousness to full spiritual bloom, in other words, following the path of spiritual evolution, while enduring the diversion, the delusions of the chattering monkey mind, confronts the hopeful soul. The possibility of spiritual evolution is hampered by the misuse of mind powers under the sway of desires and passions. The philosophy of theosophy offers the proposition that Plato was correct. Ideas rule the world. But why? As H.P. Blavatsky wrote in Raja Yoga, it is because at the basis of existence is the monadic higher ego, a part of the essence of universal mind, unconditional, omniscient on its own plane, only potentially so in our terrestrial sphere, because it is acting through the personal self. It is mind that is key to evolution of soul in its pilgrimage back to spirit. It is mind, not the brain, that is powerful, creative, forceful. Manas is said to be the fifth principle of soul incarnating in the human state. It can be called theosophically the knower, the perceiver, the thinker, the witness on the scene. It is the link between the deific and the personal. It is the immortal incarnating from life to life. Once endowing the terrestrial entity, the human state, it becomes dual and thus problematic. The duality of Manas while incarnate makes man potentially self-conscious on two planes, the kamic or psychic, as well as the monastic or noetic. At the lowest, most personal, most animal-like levels, mind is enmeshed in form and thus contained. Impulses and sensory perceptions, reactive instinct, memory can delude the thinker. And the more a thinker identifies with the workings of the lowest applications of thought, the stronger grows the desire principle, the stronger the memory forces, and therefore, the louder and stronger the sound of the chattering monkey mind. As B.P. Wadia wrote in his article, Slayer of the Real, mind is the victim of internal images composed of elemental lives which form the desire principle. And it is this misapplication of creative force of thought that awakens the senses to activity. Indulging in daydreams or uncontrolled reactionary thinking rejuvenates impress created in the past. Memories cloud the current use of mind. Frequently, when we hear a statement of the first fundamental proposition, the analogy of absolute abstract motion is presented. Mind is the perfect concept, especially the monkey mind. It's the perfect concept to use when considering the vibratory eternal change of state of life. The stream of consciousness is reflected from low to high. Creative magnetic use of force is ongoing, nonstop. Passivity or lack of concentration allows the chattering to be ongoing and therefore creates a new impress that will continue the cycle to come back to the soul in the future. It is the nature of mind that we need to study in all of human nature, ourselves and our companions, and in great nature. We may begin as thinkers merely aware or enamored of the most mundane or superficial aspects of life, the illusions of daily life. But through study and otherwise, we can become more aware. But left to its own devices, Manas, in particular what is called Kama Manas, will demonstrate four natural peculiarities. And this is where the monkey mind can lead a tremendous chattering and lead the soul, the perceiver, way off course. Four tendencies. The first two having to do with the natural motion of Manas is that mind tends to fly off from any one point. we notice in the chattering mind that it's difficult to be centered, not distractible. And then there's memory at work that produces a couple of other tendencies. Mind tends to go to some pleasant idea, or it tends to fly off to some unpleasant idea. And here we see daydreaming, fancy, worry, anxiety, everything that's distractible. And then, of course, there's the fourth tendency, and that is to remain passive and consider naught at this plane. Naturally, that would be sleep, but we see examples of that unnatural inactivity in psychic scenarios, and certainly among the abnormal or insane. So, mind, the universal electromagnetic principle shared by all souls, but self-conscious in the human state, can be lifted to introspection and intuition, can be developed to bring heart to the use of logic, cognition, and reason. Mind can become proactive. An individual can leaven the whole. The habitual chatter of the monkey mind, a natural reflection of the gunas and past use of life force, can be transmuted. And the second portion of this morning's panel will deal with that issue, the solution.
Before beginning with this presentation, we will just take a few moments to highlight some of the main points of the first presentation. So we have had presented the idea that the real man, the thinker, is a spiritual being in evolution. And throughout its long pilgrimage, it has two goals. One is to raise itself to self-conscious awareness of this truer realization of the self, but also at the same time to raise by degrees the consciousness in all the different life in which that thinker comes in contact with it, to raise the thinker at all degrees of consciousness gradually to the self-conscious godhood. And what that means is a truer realization that spiritually and essentially we are all one and identical. So when that mind being incarnates to gain the necessary experience, it becomes dual in its potentiality. And we've had that very well described for us as the potentiality of the higher mind, the source of our intuition and various other spiritual faculties on this plane, and the lower mind, its instrument for contacting the lower degrees and lives of nature around us. And yet there is a problem, because the lower mind, when it incarnates, as stated in the voice of the silence, gathers dust while it reflects, and it needs the gentle breezes of the soul wisdom inherent impacted in the higher mind to brush away the dust of our illusions. And this dust is made up of memories and impressions and is continuously replenished every day by the influence of desire and the actual motion of the lower mind, as we've had described to us. So instead of hearing the one voice of the silence, the spiritual intuition of our higher mind, we instead hear the many voices of the memories and impressions impressed in our lower mind. So the path of spiritual evolution in this cycle, when desire is still very strong and the higher mind is only beginning to awaken in human beings, it is important for us to take up the path, the struggle, the task of silencing that distracting voice and voices of the chattering lower mind So as said, the true spiritual intuition can come through. And so this morning in this part of the presentation, we are going to put forth some of the steps that are given to us in the teachings of Theosophy. And it's important to realize that none of these steps can really be missed. Like going up a stairs, one leads to the other. And yet at the same time, they can all be practiced every day, wherever we are, wherever we find ourselves. So the first step is to examine our motive. Because in any task that we take up, motive will be the power that drives action towards the completion of that task and ultimately determines the results that we get from the actions we take. So the first step, once again, is to examine our motive. But we can't do that without some kind of discerning or discrimination. And the discerning that we need to be able to do is discern the difference between the better and the dearer motive. Now, it's easy to describe the difference. It's a lot more difficult to discern, because the dearer motive leads us to pursue what is better for oneself. The better motive also leads us to pursue what is better, but better for all, and that includes ourselves. So that's a big decision, to look at our motives and discern how we want to approach this from the point of view of the motive of achieving what is better for ourselves as individuals, or what is better, let's say, for humanity, for all human beings. And so a decision has to be made at that point, and we have to decide whether we're going to choose the path of liberation from all the obstacles that stand in the way of our individual development and salvation. And in this case, that would be the motive of escaping the voices of the chattering mind, which are so distracting from our own individual spiritual development. And then there is the other path, the path of renunciation, of the desire for personal reward, individual salvation, in order to strive for the liberation of all from the suffering and woes caused by ignorance, and therefore subdue the chattering mind, not because it helps us escape and achieve our own individual salvation, but it, when we subdue the chattering mind, we are in touch with that wisdom which will make us more fit to help and teach others to lift all to that realization. So we have to examine our motives, we have to discern the motive, and then we have to make a decision about what path we want to pursue. The next step is then the performance of duties. But we can only decide to perform duties based on which path we choose. If we choose what is called, in the voice of the silence, the higher path, or the path of renunciation of self-interest for the benefit of all, then in the performance of every duty, the most important as well as the most mundane, we perform what is due others in the light of that path of renunciation. Now, when you think about it, it's relatively easy for us to figure out what we have to do for our own happiness, to achieve our own goals and our own rewards and our own development. It's a lot harder and a lot more complex to figure out what we need to do to help everyone and anyone we come in contact with. What do we owe them? how should we act? What is the best way to act with a fellow human being or with all humans to help the advancement of all, not just ourselves? And so that requires knowledge. So the performance of duty then leads to the next step, which is the acquirement of knowledge. Now, there's two types of knowledge presented to us. There's the so-called head learning, or the use of the intellect to help us study, in this case, the study of theosophy, the accumulated wisdom of the ages, preserved and presented to us by those who know these things. And if we study them, it will help us brush away the dust of our illusions that have been accumulating in our minds from all our previous sources of education and influence which may have importance in themselves, but in the way are not in the service or do not have the intent of helping us pursue the path of renunciation and duty to all. And then there is the second kind of knowledge called soul wisdom, or the heart doctrine, that wisdom that lies within the heart or the higher mind. And it comes through as intuition. Now, this higher wisdom, this intuition, can only be achieved by the mental devotion, by the performance of our duties with that wisdom, with all that knowledge in mind. In other words, we study, but study in itself is not enough. It has to be practically applied as principles in the way we conduct our everyday lives. And that's where the mental devotion comes in. It's the devotion to the ideas, to those truths, by putting them into practice that opens up the gates of spiritual intuition, as it tells us in the devotional books. True wisdom, soul wisdom, is of loving deeds the child. And so we come to the next step after we acquire knowledge and we want to begin to acquire this soul wisdom. How do we do that? And that's through the practice of concentration and meditation. Now, we generally have a very limited idea of what it means to concentrate or meditate. Very often, certain practices of mind come to hand. But very often, these practices have their declared or undeclared intent of leading to one's own individual spiritual development. And so if we are going to develop a practice of concentration and meditation that's going to help us silence the chattering mind, it has to be a method that will help us pursue that higher path of liberation and benefit to all, that leads to that knowledge of how to help all, what duties need to be helped into service of all, that will help us awaken the inner knowledge and spiritual intuition that will make us fit to do that. And so it requires what is called a one-pointedness. And it's not just a single-minded focusing of our mind on a certain spot or a certain mantra or the breath or a certain pretty scene or a color. It's a one-pointedness of our whole nature. It's a one-pointedness of desire, of making all our desires subservient to the one desire of benefiting every human being, all of life, as we can. So whatever we try and whatever we desire to achieve, it's for the benefit of others. Acquire whatever we can to benefit and help others in the pursuit of their higher evolutionary goal, the one we all share. It is one-pointed of which is one pointedness of our senses. We have many different sense impressions. We have sensations of taste, touch, smell, hearing, sight, all these sensory impressions. But whenever we have these sensory impressions, we need to focus or make ourselves aware of that one sense, which is the sense of self, the sense, the inner sense of awareness that, as before it was stated, we are the observer, the experiencer, to sense in ourselves that we are that witness of all these changing senses. And when we have these memories of thought, the feelings, of desires, impressions, all these voices of the memories, we need to replace them with the one memory of who and what we are, souls in evolution. So continuously bring our mind back to that one sense and that one memory, and we might say the one action. All our actions, when you think of it, no matter what we say or what we do, are expressions of our thought. They're the outward expressions of our thought. But what we want to do is to make our thought, make our words and our deeds the expression of one, the one eternal truth. And that is a process of development. We are all in search of that one eternal truth. And so at different times, we have a different understanding of what it is. But in any one moment, there is an ideal or an idea that expresses the highest we can conceive about life, about the source of life, about ourselves. And so what we want to do is one-pointedly make our current actions the best expression of that one truth ideal we perceive. And what will happen as we evolve and we get newer realizations of what that truth is, our actions will follow suit and becoming more refined. The final step on which everything hinges and to which everything is leading is self-sacrifice. Because when you think about it, you can pursue all these things, and there still is a degree of spiritual selfishness. What's in it for me? What's in it for me as a personal being? What's in it for me as an individual thinker, a mind being, the observer? What's in it for me as a spiritual being going the same throughout a long period of evolution? All these things, all these thoughts of what's in it for me, all have a sense of separateness. Either separateness as persons, separateness as different thinkers, separateness as different monadic expressions acquiring knowledge over the long period of evolution. The only way we can achieve a higher degree of self-sacrifice, which does not include any degree of sense of separateness, is to become gradually self-consciously aware and selfless. And that means we center our awareness and our thought and all our actions in performance of that what we call the higher self, that spark of divinity in each and all that in essence is one and separate from deity, all of life. And so in the performance of action, we give up any notion of separate development as persons, as individual souls, as higher souls, and think only of what is universal, of what is best for the all. Now that is the highest goal, the highest ideal, the highest privilege and opportunity set before us. And once again, but even at the beginning, we can begin the process by asking ourselves, what is our motive? And as we do, we bit by bit let go of all this chattering, all this concern about what's going to happen to us, what's our motive, what should we do here, what should we do there, in any concern for ourselves as individual beings, and rather it's replaced by the one silent voice of spiritual wisdom, which has its source in that one principle, which is ourselves. It is the light of that divine presence shining forth in every mind being, or capable of shining forth in every mind being, to the extent that we let it and silence the distractions of the lower mind. So in these two presentations, we've outlined the problem, why it's there, and the necessity for it being there. And we've also tried to outline the steps by which we can solve the problem, not just for ourselves, but for all of life. At this point, your questions and comments are welcome. MJW, did you have a hand?
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is all well and good. And we're just wondering, though, how can we best interact and perhaps help those who are so driven by success and externals and personal goals, which are just focused on themselves? How can we approach them? Because we certainly, I mean, that's quite a few people are like that. So not to say that they're not good people, but their focus is on really on themselves and their success and the external. So how do we interact and approach such a person in the best way, meeting them where they are, as it were?
Well, we think, first of all, we've made a judgment.
Okay.
We've judged them, if that's their motive. So Okay. That's the first step. So the first thing, let's follow the steps. We see somebody we think might be that way, but we can't make a judgment. So we might ask them, you know, we notice you do all these things. Why do you do it? What drives you? What gets you up in the morning? And we might be surprised that maybe they're doing it for their family, or maybe they're doing it because they didn't have those opportunities and they don't want their children to have to go through what they did. We don't know. But the point is for them to be able to express it. And if they say that their motive is in any way self-centered or obstructive to a higher evolution, we might say to them, well, that's all well and good, but do you ever find that your very motive to do certain things for certain reasons gets in the way of what you want to achieve? Did you ever wonder if there could be a better reason that wouldn't get in the way? That's the starting point, because everybody has to start with the first step of being aware of their motive and whether it's leading to the results they want or not, just as we do. So we think it's more important what they understand as to what we judge them to be doing. There is a chat.
You want to read it?
Okay.
I'll read it.
Okay.
Either way. Okay. An idea comes to mind about helping people who only care about external rewards, but who are unhappy at heart. We lead by example and let them know that happiness comes from the joy of helping others?
Well, we think that ties into what was previously said. If you ask somebody if they achieve all these things they want to achieve, power, fame, wealth, does that really make them happy? Or do they ever wish they could achieve those things and be happier within themselves? So once again, the path is helping others take the next step. And in order to do that, we have to, being not all wise, we have to inquire and ask them where they are, what they feel should be done. Yes, our co-panelist has a...
The other thing that came to mind was sometimes posing a Socratic question, like, did you ever get the feeling of asking yourself, is this all there is? Are you ever perplexed by that? That kind of open-ended question can sometimes spark a conversation in the moment, but also plants a seed to empower each person in the conversation for continued contemplation of the issue.
There's a question from Theosophy Hall.
And we also wonder about, we've been talking about doing external interactions, but we wonder about, should some of these interactions be done internally? We're talking about quieting the chattering mind. So if we look at quieting the mind, wouldn't that help? If we can get someone to maybe look at this idea of quieting their mind, maybe that would help change their outward expressions.
So could we help people to calm down, as it were, and quiet their minds? How can we facilitate that?
Well, the question arises immediately is, where is the responsibility of soul, and what's the starting point? Is our duty in life to control another soul, to direct another soul, to determine when that other soul needs to do XYZ? Or is the duty initially to start the way you would throw a pebble in the water? Start with the person in the mirror and work on those aspects of these steps towards spiritual evolution within, seeking the responsibility of the particularized self-conscious entity that we sense, and relying on law that as we emanate this endeavor, as we sustain this endeavor, we will magnetically impact all lives in process and draw to ourselves those seekers who are looking for these same steps. But again, it comes back, are we judging us and them? That person needs assistance. How can I help that person? Or is it a oneness of effort that starts within?
So to follow up on that, the path of spiritual evolution, while it's a path for all beings, has different stages. And we rise by degrees according to our own self-determination. And so at a certain stage, for those who want to gain direct true spiritual knowledge so that certain benefits might be obtained to make them better able to help teach in others, it becomes a necessary duty to silence the chattering mind. But even before that point, we think we can help people realize that the chattering, the wandering mind is a distraction from any skill that they want to develop. is well recognized here, that athletes perform better under pressure when they can focus. And certainly to become the best athlete you can be, or the best student you can be, you have to put away other distractions, other desires. You have to discipline yourself through a long period of training and effort in order to accomplish your goal. So by degrees, people learn or develop the tool of self-discipline and self-evolution by being able to identify what their highest desire is and work towards it. And in the course of time, because of that, the fact that each personality we see is really an expression of something higher within us all, as that instrument becomes more refined by that practice, the higher can come through better. And bit by bit, they'll feel that inspiration, but it'll come in their own time, in their own place, according to their own efforts, and not, as was said, pushed or pulled by some external source.
Motive was mentioned as being very important. Can we hear a little bit about motive? About, is that like the overall number one focus of ours?
We placed it number one because motive, which is the principle of desire in action, is behind all action. Mental, physical in terms of organs of action or speech, whatever. For human beings, what determines our action is the reasons we do it. And for most of us now in our period of evolution, our motive is determined more by our desire than it is by our ideas. Our ideas, our explanations, our reasons are colored more by desire than they are by wisdom. So very often we find ourselves doing things that we know we shouldn't do, but we do them anyway because of the influence of desire. So motive is key. And since where we are in evolution, we'll find that we have mixed motives. Do we not? We have a mixture of the very human condition for us now is a mixture of motives. So we must realize that sometimes our motives are less than they could be. And so that is necessary where we have to begin. We have to begin with the ship we have, the vehicle we have, and make sure it's headed in the direction we want it to go. It's driving. We have to make the adjustments of the wheel so that our actions will get us where we want to go and why we want to go. The next step, of course, is just discerning left from right. You know, when we're off the track and when we're on it, but at least we have to know what our goal is, what our motive is at the beginning.
And that self-reflection, that introspection or examination of motive is something that we try to set up in three different steps, if you will, of contemplation. When we first arise in the morning, and we are setting a tone for the day, becoming at one with the all for the day, we begin to envision the ideal motive to be focused, to be sustained. We make an attempt as a novice, as a student, throughout the course of the day, throughout the life's meditation, to try to see, where are we? Is that motive still sustained and one-pointed, or has the chattering mind gotten us off course and are we someplace else? And then the third time of contemplation, if you will, introspection, occurs at the end of the day, before bed, when we look back at the day and consider, I was at one, I tried to attune myself with a particular motive. I experienced a series of events and reactions and internal chatter. How'd I do? What have I learned about that motive? What have I learned about the mixed motive? And how can I improve that? What questions do I still have that need to be answered so I can be more discerning? MDW, your hand was up.
Yes. Is the barometer for this motive being selfish, unselfish, or selfless? Is that a barometer for us to evaluate our motive?
Well, we spoke about it all hinges on self-sacrifice. But when we say self-sacrifice, what are we sacrificing in ourselves? If we think of ourselves as personalities, going on a diet could be self-sacrifice. Going to the gym to develop our physical muscles could be self-sacrifice. Saving our money so that we have more money to buy the things we want for ourselves and our family, that could be self-sacrifice. But as said, it's all based on our awareness ourselves as separative persons. So therefore, our motive is, in that sense, lesser. And then we think of ourselves as individual mind beings. We can go through the same process, but the idea is the way we think, how we conceive of ourselves at time, whether as personalities, thinkers, spiritual beings, evolution, that's going to determine what we're willing to sacrifice. So if we think of ourselves as mind being who's trying to escape all the distractions of terrestrial life so it can enjoy spiritual rest, we might think we have to sacrifice association with others and be a hermit or go into isolation. And so we separate ourselves from them, but we still have all this chattering in our mind going on because we still think of ourselves as individual mind beings. We still have those desires. We've just separated ourselves or been willing to let go of those things that we think will distract our own mental development. And then we can go even higher. But that's the point. As we get more selfless, the nature of our self-sacrifice, and we become, in a sense, more pure in our motive. But it's evolution, is it not? It's by degrees. It's a process of unfoldment. But we still have to have, as was said, a barometer, a way of gauging where we are, why we're there, and where we want to go from there.
And sometimes that barometer is as simple as the awareness of where we've placed mind in the moment. In this moment, are we mindful and engaged and aware of the action or the be-ness of that moment? Or are we triggering our memories from the past arising in the chattering mind, and we're actually attending to them? We're distracted from what is in the moment by what has come up as an impression from the past. Or are we distracted by a recollection, a memory of something that was painful in a moment similar to what we're experiencing, and therefore our mind flies off. We're no longer in that active, creative oneness of the moment, but rather we're worried about the outcome or what's going to happen next. MDW, follow up, and then MJW. Unmute, please.
We were just considering the idea of meditation, you know, of quieting that monkey mind or that distractive mind. And the question comes up, well, when you do that, you sit quietly and you quiet that chattering mind, what do you do in that silence? What do you do in that darkness? Do you let the mind, you keep it still, just being observant? Or or what do you consider or do you consider not?
Well, that's the key question in when it comes to meditation. Depends on what path you're on. Because if your path is one of lowering the chattering mind so you can have mental rest and peace, then you will seek that passivity of mind in which there is no disturbance. There is but blankness, no distracting thought. And that leads to a path of individual liberation. But the higher one also leads to a silencing of the mind, but replaces it with a fullness of knowledge, which obscures or blocks out the chattering of mind. So, you can be listening to music, and then there's a loud thunderclap or a storm going outside, and the vibration and the intensity of that sound obliterates for that time the music that you hear. So if we draw by analogy, if we want to silence the mind and yet achieve that wisdom that's going to help us grow and help others, during our periods of meditation, whether set for a certain period of time or throughout the day, we have to draw the mind back to those points of wisdom. As it says, the mind needs breadth and depth to help it clear away these illusions. And the breadth and depth is reflection on those ideas that we've studied and those ideals which we believe to be the highest, to dwell on them and to view our lives in the light of those. And as while we're doing that, we are so taken up with it that the voices of the lower mind are silent. And then it becomes just merely a practice of being able to do that, to silence that mind when we need to the achievement of a certain goal. We saw a hand go up. Is that JF? Unmute, please.
Actually, MJW was before me, so okay.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna add that the Patanjali yoga by Judge is a good read yes. for this conversation. So for this topic. Right. So right. Thank you. Yeah. Right.
Thank you so much for that, because there he further develops this idea of chattering, which we've looked at a very limited way, because he speaks there of modifications of the mind. And he says yoga or union with the higher is overcoming the modifications of the mind. And there are several he gives. Chattering is just one of them. So yes, it's one of those. And Judge in the preliminary to that document, which he translated, tells us that the mind there is like a vase that takes on the shape and the qualities of that it attaches itself to. So we may lower the chattering mind, but we then have to allow the mind to be taken up with the fullness of spiritual ideas in order for it to grow. Yes, MJW?
We're going to see, because it's fine. It's we'll pass on it. We'll pass.
Okay, well, there's nothing else to pass to right now.
So. Okay, well, all right. Okay, well, we have read in the philosophy that we are ceaselessly self-deceived. And when we read that, we thought, oh my goodness. If we're ceaselessly self-deceived, how can we ever get anywhere?
No, well, please come next week, because that will be the
okay. That's why we thought we'd save it for another time.
Well, you know, we were having a conversation earlier with a fellow student about the idea of approaching a subject with the attitude that we know everything. So when we approach another person or another subject with the attitude that we know or think, know it all already, that's when the warning flag goes up. We are secretly self-deceived. by the impression that our learning is complete, that we know it all. We never know it all. We only know what we are capable of at the time. Even as spiritual beings on the course of evolution throughout an entire period of manifestation of the cosmos, that cosmos exists for the evolution of our learning, our awareness. But in a future period of evolution with a higher, much more refined expression, that possibility goes on further. So we may reach a perfection of understanding relative, but only a portion of what is possible. So that's where self-deceived, and we hope that doesn't take too much away from the next week.
And we have just about a minute. The quotation from the Blavatsky book for today is very, very crucial to this evolution, if you will, this path, this process. The essence of theosophy is the perfect harmonizing of the divine with the human in man, the adjustment of his godlike qualities and aspirations, and their sway over the terrestrial or animal actions in him. Kindness, absence of every ill feeling or selfishness, charity, goodwill to all beings, and perfect justice to others as to oneself are its chief features. So the path is as simple or as complex as the starting point.
So we'll close today's meeting then just with a reminder that once again, next Sunday's forum presentation is on the idea of slaying the illusions of the mind. And Wednesday evening's class from the Ocean of Theosophy is on the subject of reincarnation, specifically addressing the question, what is it that reincarnates? So, wish you all well and have a good day.
Thank you. Bye. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.